Hey, this is JT, and welcome to another episode of The Critical Thought. April is Autism Awareness Month, also referred to as Autism Acceptance. We try to give voices to people who've had different experiences being involved with the Jehovah's Witnesses. In today's episode, our guests will share with us their experience of being one of Jehovah's Witnesses dealing with the challenges of autism.
You're listening to The Critical Thought, where we challenge our listeners to use critical thinking when examining the teachings of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Hi, this is Lady C. Welcome to The Critical Thought. And my guest today is M, and she's going to be talking about her experience being one of Jehovah's Witnesses and how she woke up. And she has a very interesting story to tell that can basically help a lot of people. I really feel like her story is so compelling, and I just can't wait until we get into this discussion. So, Em, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You are so welcome. So you want to start off just by talking a little bit about how you got interested to this religion known as Jehovah's Witnesses?
I feel like I've had a little bit of a hybrid of both a born-in experience and a from the door-to-door work type of experience. My mom ran into someone. She met someone who started a study with her, and she studied a baptism less than a year. She was like fast-tracked, and then something happened, and she was disfellowshipped. And I think at the time, I was probably about 8 years old. I was 8 years old. So she raised us, though. I mean, she became pomy, basically. She still felt like it was the truth, but that she had failed. And so we followed to the best of her ability. We didn't do holidays. We didn't do this. We didn't do that. And that was basically my whole childhood, was basically observing these rules, but having no support from the congregation. When I was 17, I moved out. Most of us moved out pretty early. And my mom's only thing was that, we each get a study. She's like, you know, if you become a witness or not, that's fine. But I feel like my greatest failure as a parent was possibly preventing you from everlasting life and knowing about the true God. So actually, all of us got a study when we moved out. I was the first to actually get baptized. And the only other one, and there's eight of us. I've got five brothers, two sisters. The only other one that got baptized was a little sister of mine. And that was like 10 years later. And she washed out pretty quick as well. So I moved out and I called the witnesses and asked for a study. They sent somebody out. I studied for a while. I was love bombed in the beginning because, oh my goodness, this girl, she called on her own and she's a young person. But I was also at the same time as being love bombed. It was so superficial. It only applied to the Kingdom Hall. So I really wasn't invited much to many of the outside activities, the get togethers, because I think I still kind of had the world on me and people were a little unsure. And I kind of equate it to, you know, when somebody is maybe born in or they're part of the congregation and their parents get disfellowshipped, then the child sort of vicariously is treated as if they somehow are tainted. So that was kind of me. I had to prove myself. I had to show that I was taking this seriously. And so I worked pretty hard.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You were like a fatherless child.
Yeah. And it's not like the organization loves labels. They need to be able to put you in a box. If they can't put right. you in a box, it has nothing to do with their lack of boxes. It has to do with you. You are normally, mm-hmm. So yeah, I didn't fit into any of those predetermined boxes. So it was a little bit different. I didn't get quite as much, I guess, that warmth or whatever as a truly new study, because they knew that I had this worldly mother.
What actually happened after you got baptized with you and your mom? What kind of a relationship did you guys have after that?
I don't think I understood the full impact quite as much as my mom did, because she showed up at my baptism and my Bible studies husband said, hey, there's a woman who's been staring at you. I'm like, do you know her? She's like kind of dressed in the nines. I'm like, no. So I look around and it was my mom, and she came over and she hugged me and she said, I'm proud of you. I'm so proud of you, baby. I'm proud of you. Then she kind of got back. She leaned back and she said, well, this is it. And she walked away. Oh my gosh. In that moment, I realized that baptism meant saying goodbye to my mom. No one actually told me that explicitly while I was studying. So I wasn't, and I guess I should have known, but I got baptized, you know, after like diligent study. I didn't realize it. I thought, you know, because she was the one that introduced me, she clearly wasn't a bad association. But yeah, so my mom self-shunned after that. So I knew that if she called me, it was necessary, because she only called me when it was necessary because of, you know, she knew the rules better than I did at that point. That was hard. So, you know, I hear these stories about people who are just waking up and they're losing their family. I lost mine the moment I came in.
That is really an interesting story, because this is the first time I've ever heard of a story like this before, of all the people I've spoken to, where, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses, whenever you're studying the Bible, and we talk about this a lot on our channel, about how they're so intense to get you indoctrinated, and they never tell you about this shunning. Mm-mm. And about what happens to people when they leave and what your relationship is going to be like. And for you to get baptized and then immediately wake up and realize, oh my God, this means my baptism means no more talking to my mother. And she knew that.
Yeah, she did. And I think there was a little bit of cognitive dissonance at that point, because she was losing her baby, but she was so proud of me. Like, this was the proudest she could be of me. And she was so happy that she was saying goodbye.
Yeah.
So it was really, I mean, honestly, for me, it was kind of a mind thing. It was pretty hard.
You know what it reminds me of? Remember that movie called The Titanic? Mm-hmm. And everybody couldn't get on the boats to get to safety. It kind of reminds me of a mother who realizes that she can't get on that boat, but she wants her kids on there.
Yeah.
And she's willing to die and sacrifice for them. But she doesn't, you know, but it's a little bit different in this case, because this is just something she doesn't want. But it's almost like, I've got to get you on that boat. If I can get you on that boat, I can get you everlasting life. Yeah. Even though I realize I'm not going to get on the boat. I'm not going to, there's no room for me on the boat, but I want you on that boat.
Yeah. It was kind of surreal. And I think the other hard thing was that my mother never put down the association. She believed it was the truth. She believed she wasn't good enough. She believed that she wasn't worthy. I don't know what had happened. I really don't know why she was disfellowshipped, but whatever it was left her with the impression that she was just too damaged to be accepted. And so, yeah, she threw me in what she thought was the lifeboat and set me adrift.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what this religion did to you. You know, how did it affect your choices in education, careers, and things like that?
I had earned a full ride scholarship through, I think at the time it was called the Portland Teachers Program. I gave up a full ride. It was a teaching scholarship. So basically it was through my bachelor's and then my master's of ed. It was all completely paid for through this program that, I mean, I literally had won this. I worked really hard and this was something that I had gotten. And I was basically convinced that Armageddon wouldn't be around by the time I graduated. And I needed to focus on spiritual things here and now, and just to get a trade, do something quick, you know, something, you know, or maybe just get married. I gave it up. I didn't accept the scholarship. I didn't go to school.
Sorry to hear that. You and so many other people, right? You know, you realize just how futile it is listening to the Watchtower. Did you ever go on assembly programs or convention programs and talk about how you gave up your scholarship?
No.
Okay.
No.
But people knew about it though, didn't they?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just expected. I don't think, you know, the Mormons are different. They all do the whole school thing, mm-hmm. but Witnesses are just expected not to go to school. And I think I would have become more of a pariah if I would have went to school, because already, you know, I kind of had the world on me, that stink of the world, because I have this disfellowshipped mother. And I'm a single early 20s person. Then I'm also going to be going in for higher ed. That whole idea, that whole notion really made me look more of a rebel. And I was trying to just not make waves and just prove that I was worthy of being there. I mean, again, my mother didn't feel worthy. And I just had this enormous weight that I felt like I had to show that I was worthy.
How about marriage? What was it like? Did you ever date anybody in the congregation? Brothers? What did you think about brothers and getting into the relationships with them? What was that like?
So, you know, singles. Okay. So first of all, there are a couple of reasons for this. One, I have five brothers and two sisters, and I was very close to my brothers, and I kind of communicate better with males. I'm on the spectrum. And so I ended up having more friends who were males than females. It's just the way it was. And I actually had this group, kind of a geek squad. It's funny because they were engineers.
Oh, and really?
I was the only one that wasn't. Yeah. One of the brothers moved up from California, and somehow he had finished his engineering degree before he came up. And another was actually one of my Pioneer partner friends. He had done a lot of night classes, et cetera. So he pioneered while going to school, which no one told me was an option. So yeah, I had all these friends, and we used to do a lot of crazy things. So, but they were all innocent, and I wasn't interested in any of them. I could never imagine myself married to a brother and being a Christian wife the way it was expected, where this other person is supposed to see me as equal, and yet I'm so lesser, where I'm dependent on him for every thought. I mean, think of how much control a watchtower has on individuals, but in a marriage, that one person being my head and basically being entrusted with all of my decisions. They start with me, but they end with this person. So it just wasn't my thing. And so I didn't really date. I think there was one brother in all my time in the org that I ever actually liked, but most of the brothers that I knew, I was just friends with.
But let me ask you this. So can we talk about your unique perspective and the issues that you faced and how you were dealt with because of it in the congregation with the elders?
Okay. So in case watchers haven't noticed it yet, I'm on the spectrum. I was diagnosed with ASD1, autism spectrum disorder. It's something you're born with. It's interesting because it's something that you're born with and your family knows. I'm one of eight. And my mom didn't have a word for it back then. She just knew something. So when I finally, as an adult, went and did the evaluation, which was like three, like very, very long days. And there were, I don't know how many tests and evaluations, et cetera, with the specialist. And they did familial history and childhood history and all of these other, there's lots of components that go into it. And I let her know. I was like, hey, remember that thing I told you I was going to do and I needed this information for? And I'm like, well, it looks like, and she's like, yeah, okay, well, so you just paid how much to learn what we already knew? So it wasn't like, you know, whatever. My siblings were all like, didn't you always have autism? I'm like, yeah. So what'd you pay that guy for? I'm like, so it's something that I have. And a couple of things happened. First of all, I had for a while been seeing an autism specialist, a coach, basically, a psychologist who specializes in kind of helps navigate the non-autistic world, because it really is geared for non-autistic people. We're the minority. And at one point he told me that he had a couple of clients who were Jehovah's Witnesses, but trying to fade, which I had not heard of before. My therapist knew before I did. And I was, you know, He's like, no, because I wasn't awake. And he's like, well, you know, if you want, I can give you some resources or I can connect you guys. I'm like, oh no, they're apostates. And so he's like, well, okay, I won't bring that up again. Then if that makes you uncomfortable, we'll, you know, if your goal is to stay in, then we'll figure out things that you can do to stay in. And he actually, we would sometimes discuss some of the difficulties that I had. For example, car groups. One of the things that I suffer from is when I'm in a group of people, I can't distinguish voices. I can't differentiate. So when people are talking over each other or whatever, I can't follow. I can't track. So even like my last job, I worked at a hospital. And one of the accommodations that I had was that I never had to actually go to meetings. We did it differently where I could just do audio because otherwise nothing. So we talked about the car group and my therapist is like, well, how are you at the door? And I go, oh, I like the door. It's like, you know, one person and it's easy to focus and you're not talking over each other. Those are the rules. And he's like, well, can you drive yourself into the territory and then, you know, get a partner? And so I tried that and the brothers couldn't refuse to understand. And, it got to the point where it was just really debilitating. So for me, most people who are on the spectrum, when you've got something, you've got one challenge, then it kind of snowballs to the other, sort of like sensory overload. So if I'm in a car and there's all of this sound and I'm becoming overloaded, then all of a sudden I can smell everybody's perfume and everyone's deo and everyone's soap. And I would just, it was like this, and I've got synesthesia. So, it was loud. The smells were like screaming. It was like being in a car where everyone's going, and so then I would get into like, I would get out of the car to go to the territory and I'm needing a minute and I would have to walk to the end of the block. And then come back. And, you know, if you ask a sister to tone down their perfume, then they take it very personally and they don't understand. They get pissed off. So I try to explain to the brothers, like, I really like working with sister so-and-so out of the car where the air can kind of dissipate all that funk around her. But sorry, you might think it smells good, but not when you're stuck in a car with them talking to you. Then it's just all bad. But I had a couple of elders who... I remember once in the territory, I was struggling and it wasn't like I didn't like service. I actually did. And I did LDC and I did all these other things. I explained and one of the brothers was like, oh, it's a learning disability. And I said, no, I am autistic and I'm telling you what it is. And this is really hard for me because, and I tried to explain, and he looks at the other brother and he goes, well, what do you think it is? I'm right there. I'm trying to tell you that I'm suffering and I'm trying to get through this. And the other brother goes, yeah, it's a behavioral problem and probably a little bit of mental illness in there as well.
Oh my God.
I'm right there. No, it's not a mental illness, but you know, just so you know, I actually did have my therapist because I was like, do I have anything else going on? Can I take some other, you know, whatever? And he's like, literally, you're just autistic and you've got some comorbid anxiety. So yeah, just basically being treated as if, I mean, they were just so ignorant. And they held on to that ignorance because I was something that they couldn't identify from the literature that they had read. So I finally, like, you know, got onto my phone and I pulled up a couple of articles and of course, scientific articles, they don't necessarily like so much. And one of the brothers was like, oh, well, I've never seen it said like that before. I just said it to you like that. And part of it is being a woman. You know, we are lesser and we're not really supposed to speak up much. And we do, final say goes to them. And these brothers, you know, they have their little submissive wives. And it was so demeaning and dehumanizing. And I had no help. Like, I'm doing my best to serve Jehovah and, you know, get all those hours in. And I felt like, I always felt like I needed to do more to prove myself worthy, because I had a disfellowship mom, and also to prove to her as well that she didn't, you know, waste my life by not teaching me more when I was little. So I had all this on my shoulders, and yet I didn't get any help. And I think one thing I did mention to you was I could imagine myself in paradise. I just didn't want to be there. And I remember like these prayers that I would have where it's like, you know, okay, I'm trying to do your will. I hope that you find favor in me. I'm doing my best. I'm not doing it because I want to go to paradise, and I don't want you to save me. I mean, I know other people, it was like the thing that kept them in was mm-hmm. saving themselves. I didn't like witnesses. Like I didn't feel good in the group because you see that hypocrisy. And so I would pray that he would use me. You know, here I am, send me, use me, use me, use me, use me, so that, you know, I'm not responsible for anyone's destruction, but please don't resurrect me. Don't let me live through this. And I prayed that all the time, because they weren't the most loving people, or So it was so important to my mom that she was willing to give me away. And
it's like cognitive. I would say that would be cognitive dissonance.
It was cognitive dissonance. Yeah. It doesn't feel like the truth, but you're saying it's the truth. So I'm going to keep doing what I'm supposed to be doing. That kind of thing. Yeah.
I felt that way too. And not the part about not being in paradise, but I thought like I would go out in field service and I would knock on a door. And if a specific person came to the door that I felt was intelligent, mm-hmm. I would say to myself, I know they don't want no parts of this crazy stuff. That's how I felt. And I'd be like, but it didn't really dawn on me until after we left that I was actually looking at certain people and actually saying that I don't think that they would fit in the Jehovah's Witness culture.
Right.
But at the same time, you're saying it's the truth, but right. You didn't think that everybody would want to deal with it. But you, well, thought that you had to be there because this is the truth.
Right. And my, you know, I'm obedient. My mama said, but I do remember other sisters saying, oh my gosh, I met this person in field service. She is such a witness. She's going to be a witness, because they had that thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I ever had that thing or that desire. Like it just, imagine never getting out of the org and being in the congregation. I am so much happier now. Like now I don't have those thoughts. Now I actually want to live. before I was like oh, come on, I'm again.
Right.
I can't keep living like this. Like, can I just be done with my work?
Amazing. It's amazing how they have a strong hold on people, making you think this is the truth to the point that you know it makes no sense. You know you don't want to be there, but you're thinking, oh, God, do I got to do this? You know? Oh, it's terrible. It's a bad place to be.
One of my, just really quickly, a story that I think of sometimes, Jonah. And the fish, the whale, whatever. Uh-huh.
Right.
I always hated him. I just did. And I don't know how he got so much praise, because he never did what he was supposed to do, right? Go this way. So he goes that way. He ends up almost getting people killed. He goes, you know, in the water. And he's like, I'm so sorry. Once he gets swallowed, whatever. So then he gets to Nineveh and he's got this message to proclaim. You guys are all going to die. And I kind of feel like if there was a real God, this might be his way of letting us know who the witnesses really are, because he gets to Nineveh and they hear this proclamation and they're contrite and they feel bad and they rip their clothes off and they put on sackcloths and ashes, even the dogs. Remember even the dogs they had? And the whole town like apologize. They know they're going to die, but they apologize to God and he spares them. And that MF-er, Jonah, gets mad because he wanted them all to die. And I'm like, that's not the most witnessy thing. Like they're looking towards, like they're looking gleefully towards destruction. You go out in service and they want to go to the nice area so they can pick out their house, their after Armageddon house, when people that live there currently are obliterated.
Exactly.
The most vile, non-loving, sick people. Like
just on the planet, like, right? Oh my God, that is so crazy.
Jonah, complete, like it was like the whole congregation was Jonah. Like they were looking for people to die so that they could.
So they could inherit what they had.
Uh-huh. Right. Sick. Absolutely sick. So
that is amazing. Well, I am so glad that you feel freed after leaving the religion because it was so confining.
It was.
You know, and I really hate the fact that you had to go through that with those brothers and dealing with your situation. You gave an example of being in a car group and having the issues and stuff like that. And you knew what to do. I thought that was really impressive. What your therapist was telling you to maybe drive to the territory yourself. Had you ever thought about any of that before?
He was great. No, like he was, like, I wish I could have had him like my little CNI dog in the congregation. Because mm-hmm. He even helped me with like, I get overwhelmed, like I said, when there's like tons of people around. And sometimes like some sisters will hug you and you're just like, and I'm a massage therapist, but I mm-hmm. don't like to be touched. It's a thing. It's very uncomfortable. It's a thing. It's a boundary thing. As a therapist, you're it's actually perfect for me. Mm-hmm. I am one-on-one. Mm-hmm. In a quiet, sensory sensitive room where the light's very dim and usually they're asleep anyway, and you're just doing your job and you are touching, but they're not wrapped around you. So okay. It's just a very uncomfortable feeling. And I need what's called transition. So when I go from one activity to another, I need a couple of minutes for my mind to reset. I can't just get up and do something different. So when I would get to the hall, I would transition to my car. I would take a couple of minutes to just sort of like get out of driving mode and get into hall mode. And then, you know, but then you get swamped sometimes by the friends, especially the elderly ones that just, they're happy to see you. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't get them to stop hugging me. And actually, so here's another situation that I had with regards to touching and hugging. I was working construction. I was on a assembly site, and I forget, we were just doing maintenance, and there was a brother who hugged me. Really? I think he was even married. Ew, really? So, you know, I was like, yeah, nope, I'm not, I just don't. And he's like, what do you mean you don't? We're all friends. You're my sister. First of all, I don't even remember his name because he wasn't in one of my halls. I just saw him all the time there. And I was like, yeah, but I personally do not hug. And he's like, well, but, you know, that's how you know that we're part of God's organization. We love each other, yada, yada. And then I said, I have a sensory integration disorder that's part of autism spectrum disorder. And it's very uncomfortable for me when you do that. It doesn't feel good to me. So, and he's like, oh, so basically you're saying everyone needs to conform to what benefits you. That's not what I said. I'm saying that you're physically hurting me. Like it's, I can't even just, it's like a
creepy feeling.
Yeah. You know, when you're in a bad dream and you've got that, like it that's what it feels like. That's what, especially with him. And, finally, and he wouldn't stop. And then he got others and he's like, what do you think when somebody says like, oh, I don't like this. And so the whole congregation has to change and revolve around them. Don't you think they're being really selfish? Like he was bringing other people into this conversation. And finally I said, brother, my mother has only hugged me 3 times in my life. And that's actually true. I've only hugged my mom 3 times. I remember 2, the third might've been 4. She swears it's 3. She's like, no, I've hugged you 3 times.
You're really educating me because I'm going to be very honest with you, because sometimes when you are around people and you don't know why they do things, and they may not even understand why they do things or not, and they could be looked at as having a personality issue. They're not loving.
It's sensory. It just physically doesn't feel good.
Right.
But people don't
understand that. What I'm saying is, it's not your fault. It's the fact that people are not being, are not willing to respect you for what you're saying.
Right. And my mom and I mean, I show affection in other ways with, with a partner. I can do that. It's a different thing. It's a comfort thing. I can do that. But it becomes sensory overload. And I probably could hug some of those sisters if it were like one-on-one, but all of a sudden, again, it's like a car group where you've got all these people and all these sounds and I'm trying to transition and I've got all these smells. And then someone does that. Holy moly. It's a lot.
My mom didn't like, you know, and you know, she's deceased now, but my mom didn't like people touching her at all. And if you came up to her and touched her, she'd be like, don't touch me.
Oh, see, I love her.
My mom was so misunderstood because she would say things and she would just get off her chest, but she wasn't having it. She would just let people know. She says, she would just tell people don't, and she would hate it if someone would come up to her and then it would hit her on her arm. Or they would just say, hey, you know, like, hey, such and such. And she would be like, don't touch me. Right. But, you know, I don't know if she could have had that issue or not, but
I think she might have.
It makes you wonder. And I mean, I'm learning a lot from people when I meet people like yourself and just people that I'm just interviewing in general. It's just I learn so much from people and different things. I'm just enjoying this whole experience.
It's a spectrum. So, you know, well, long story short with that brother, just to kind of get that off the shelf. When I told him I'd only hugged my mom 3 times in my life, he's like, oh, well, you could have led with that. Really? You're elevated with my mom? Peace out. So anyway, so I had to get that off. Like I was so done. It was another little chink. And sort of like also with a therapist, the fact that he had people who were autistic, but were leaving the organization because they saw the hypocrisy.
Okay.
Because people who are on the spectrum, we see patterns. It's kind of how our brains function. The patterns are we see them everywhere. It's probably why so many people on the spectrum are good at like math and computer sciences, et cetera, which I'm not.
Can you give me an example of the pattern? I want to know about the pattern. Give me an example.
Well, just patterns of behavior, like just patterns of hypocrisy. When you see them too. I know everybody does, but it's just for us, we kind of fixate. Trying to think of it. There's so many. People put stuff down in the bottom if you know what I mean. You kind of touched on a couple of things where they hyper focus on these little nitpicky things, but the big things not so much. And just the other patterns of control, et cetera. There's just certain things that you see so much of that it's almost, you can almost expect what they're going to do next. So autistic people tend to live in our heads and we're very sensory. One thing that most of us are known for, and again, it's a spectrum, so I can't speak for everybody. Mm-hmm. Everyone's unique and different. So if you meet one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. Everybody's going to be different. But a couple of things to know is one, we tend to be either hyper or hyposensitive to pain, to stimuli, et cetera. I broke my shoulder and I wasn't even sure if it was broken or not. Yeah. And then they wouldn't help me because I thought I was like making it up because I go, I think it might be broken. It was totally out of the socket. I chipped the socket. I tore the labrum. I was a hot mess. And then once they x-rayed it, they're like, oh my God, it was out. But the worst part of breaking my arm was the color orange. All of a sudden, everything went orange. And I was just freaking out. So sensory integration and all of that stuff. So all of our senses and everything, we're wired differently. And some people experience being around others almost as an emotion, almost as a feeling. You can feel someone, you can feel their energy. You can feel like if they like you or if they don't like you, if they're not very honest. I think it's similar to the way my dog does. Like when he meets people, you know, he just immediately is just like, mm-mm. Or he's like, oh, I like you. It's just, he just.
I can feel the genuineness of it.
Yeah. He can just tell.
Yeah.
So there's just a thing that we read. But going back to other people who, how they can get through it. One of the things that my doctor had said with regards to hugging was, make it so that your body is unhuggable by turning to the side. So when somebody comes at you this way, you go, oh, hi. And you turn and you face them this way. And now it's actually very uncomfortable for them to hug you, but you can still greet them and you greet them with a smile. You go, oh, hi. So he worked with me on all these little how to survive a congregation meeting. Like we worked for weeks. And we role played where he was sister so-and-so, sister hugs too much, or he was brother such and such. And it's how I survived because I was like, I don't know, like it's, they don't listen to me. I tell them this, but they don't listen to me. And he's like, some people won't. So what can you do?
It's almost like they were trying to say you had an issue with just being a friendly person, not even trying to figure out what you were dealing with. But at the same time, if you're telling people that you have this situation going on, then they're trying to say that it's in their mind, it's one thing. In your mind, you know, it's not. So they're disrespecting the whole, they're disrespecting your whole condition.
Again, I did not want to be resurrected. It was to that point where I was just like, please don't bring me back.
Oh my God, that is amazing.
It was horrible.
They weren't even trying to understand. But see, the thing is, because you were a sister, they don't think that sisters should have a say and you should do everything the brothers tell you to. So you were like exercising your own thought process outside of what they felt
right. That
they're leading you to do. And she's not paying attention. She's not following our lead, our orders kind of thing.
Right. And that's actually what I was told. I was told I was an independent thinker and I was seeking out worldly philosophy and this is somehow a phase. And I'm like, I was autistic from the day I skipped out of the womb. I am one of eight. My mom is a nurse, just like her twin, you know, like whatever. And she breastfed everyone except me. And I'm number four. She couldn't. I wouldn't. And here I am like screaming all the time because I'm starving. And we, you know, she took me to the pediatrician and every time she'd try to feed me, instead of latching on, I would make a little X and I would scream like I was on fire. Just
really?
It was a sensory thing. I couldn't handle the close touch. And she always talked. My mom, like, I saw her with my younger siblings. She likes to talk to you while you're eating. So I'm just like, look, lady, I need to focus. So I was the only one that was bottle fed. And basically her prescription was to put me in my bassinet with a pillow and cover it with a blanket, prop up my bottle, cover me with a blanket. And I ate just happily ever after.
That's interesting.
I just couldn't handle the sensory overload. I didn't walk until I was like, 2.5. I didn't talk until I was almost 2.5. I was nonverbal. But when I went to kindergarten, I was reading at fifth grade level and I was self-taught. I just learned a word and I was like, okay, whatever. And the teacher's like, oh, you must spend so much time with her. My mom's like, really? She can read? She's like, you know, I have this many kids, right? Oh, good. One of them can read.
You're born with this, right?
Yes. Yeah. You're just wired differently.
You're wired differently. And I'm understanding that people are adults finding out that they're autistic and they didn't realize it.
A lot of people in my group, because I was part of this Women with Autism group, a lot of them got diagnosed as adults because they felt like they were from another planet. Like they just didn't feel like they connected with people. They liked people, but they just felt like it wasn't. Like there was a disconnect and they had gone through all of this and that, or maybe they were diagnosed with this, that, or the other. And they finally got a diagnosis of, you know, autism spectrum disorder. And then, of course, you get diagnosed as an adult, and a lot of them kept it private. They were in the closet, in the autism closet. Okay. And I'm out. So they were always like, what's it like being out? I'm like, people ignore you. It's the same as being in. Like, you don't get accommodations. You just suffer. But now they know you're suffering. But in my group, we had one of the gals was a botanist. She worked for the Forestry Service or something. She helped with, like, you know, all the endangered this, that, and the other. And I don't know what she did. One was a medical technical writer. So we had some really bright minds. And a couple of them said that it went okay. And then one of them said that their boss said there's no way you could be autistic because it means this, that, and the other. And they're like, I'm autistic. So yeah, it's
a stigma.
It's a stigma. And I think it's because it's a spectrum. It's because you can go from the nonverbal to what people consider high functioning, which not isn't necessarily the case. Like, I probably seem pretty somewhat okay, but I usually can't go into Trader Joe's without headphones. So Trader Joe's has some of the, you know, that store.
Yes, I do.
The most overly friendly people on the planet work there with the loud colors and all the lights. And it's so overwhelming for me. And they're like, hi, how are you? Come on. So I put my headphones on sometimes without even noise. Like, I just have them on so that I can focus on doing what I'm there for without going into overload. A couple of times I've had to just leave the cart and go in the car and just retransition. So yeah, I do okay, but not always. But one of the things I had mentioned before I kind of want to bring out was with regards to the ignorance and the stigma of the brothers in the organization. Like, they, until a magazine comes out on autism spectrum disorder, they just don't know. And they're not going to research it, these brothers. They're just going to be willfully ignorant, and nothing you say is going to matter. And I think I mentioned before, I knew this woman. She had, I think, four or five, and three or four of them had disabilities. This was the nicest sister you would ever meet. She was always there to help out. She, you know, she was always there for hall cleaning. Her kids helped with the hall cleaning, even though they were all special needs, like, you know, the little one walking around with those big floppy gloves on. And he's, right, I'm helping, you know. But they were, no one ever came to their get togethers. They were never invited to get togethers. She had her, I think, yeah, her youngest was somewhat nonverbal autistic. And he was a flapper. He'd get upset and he'd flap. And she'd say, okay, just one more minute, get it out, get it out. And then he was fine, but she just let him do his thing. But, he was nonverbal, but probably when he was like seven, he started to have a few words, collect a few words and put a few together. So he liked to make a comment. And if the comment was one word, he could do it. Like, if they asked, how does it make you feel to think about paradise? Happy. He could say happy. So he'd raise his hand. And this woman with these children always made sure her kids had a comment prepared. They were always with their magazines. The one that was autistic, just unbelievably sweet. There was one that had ADHD, the boy with a fireball. He was like all over the place, but he could slow it down. If he saw an older sister and her purse looked heavy, he'd say, can I help you with that, sister so-and-so? I can take it to the car for you if you need me to. And he could keep it together long enough to get her to the car. Once she was in the car, he was back to like, but wow. This is, she did her best with these kids, and they were amazingly great kids. Mm-hmm. And they were treated like lepers. I mean, They were treated so badly, and it broke my heart. And she would always say, well, you know what? Jehovah's organization is full of imperfect people, and we'll get through it. And once everyone's perfected, then she would be accepted or whatever. And I was like, that's not really what that means. Mm-hmm. It's not like all of a sudden their attitudes are going to be perfected. If they're going to paradise, they're going to go as the MFers that they are right now. You know, the ones that are showing you and seeing that you've got disabled children, like the autistic one didn't learn to walk until he's like 5 or 6. He was very, very old and he had a shoe lift on one of the shoes. And so he kind of walked a little. They actually said he was never going to walk, but he could run, which was great. But, you know, she had these disabled kids and her husband was there most of the time. He was great, but he drove a truck. So sometimes he would miss a meeting or two and he would do it wherever else. No one helped her. Her kids helped.
They struggled. I saw people like that in the congregation that just struggled.
Yeah.
To make, and we, my mom had studies with people and they had kids and we would pick them up for the meetings and stuff like that. But a lot of people in the situation that you're talking about, they, like you said, they were treated like lepers.
Yeah. They would have been treated better by the autism community or a community center than they were ever treated in the congregation.
Were they getting, were they, so they were going to a community outside the organization to get help?
No. Well, they had, like PT, physical therapy and stuff, because the one for walking and he did swimming and whatnot. And everybody was nice. They didn't have any groups that they were joined. And she actually homeschooled them.
Oh, man.
Well, they told her that the youngest was never going to read, walk, or talk. They said to institutionalize him. But by the time I had left that congregation, he again was giving his little comments. He had learned knock, knock jokes.
Oh my goodness.
But the only thing he could say was knock, knock. It was horrible. It was so bad. It was like hours. Like it was like throwing a dog to a golden retriever. Like it just never. He'd go, knock, knock. And he would crack himself up. And then he would do it again. Knock, knock. But the thing was, it's like, we knew not to laugh because if you laughed, the joke would go on and on. So he would do it and you just go, that's interesting. You have to run away.
Oh my God. That's cute.
But he thought he was hysterical.
Oh my goodness.
And he thought he was a comedian. And so he did progress and it was because of homeschool. He was able to write. He could write his name. He could write Jehovah. He would, during the meetings, he would pick out words from the magazines and see him painstakingly write them, even though his hands were, it was.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I think back to those times and again, cognitive dissonance where you see the lack of love and you continue to patiently wait on Jehovah.
That is the really bad thing about the organization, because the organization never loses.
Right.
Because no matter what goes on, you're going to always be at that mode of waiting on Jehovah. And it can be pretty bad because it's like it's a never ending game.
Yeah.
That they're playing with you.
You cannot win. It's always going to be in their favor.
That's right.
If someone does something right, it's a blessing from Jehovah. It's a congregational blessing to Jehovah. And if someone does something wrong or harmful, Jehovah's going to clean his house, you know? And it's just like you're always waiting.
Or somebody's in here grieving Jehovah's Holy Spirit and that kind of stuff. And it makes people who are doing something bad come forward and say, well, that's me, brother. That's me grieving the Spirit. And it's nothing like that. Nothing.
Not anymore.
Let me ask you a question. So when you were talking about your autism and you were on a congregation level, how did you handle assemblies and conventions?
Well, I used to go in late, but that was worse. So I would go in early to save my seat.
Okay.
And then I'd go out to my car, or I would do like get away from people. And then I'd come in right before the song where people were thinned out and I could sit.
Okay.
And usually I'd have my lunch outside. So it wasn't so, so bad. It's funny because I had a student that before I had been out, before I decided I was just going to be open about being on the spectrum, I had a student and this kid, I started studying with her when she was like 12 or 13 and she knew. I didn't tell her, but she knew. One day we were studying and she's like, just look away. I'm like, what? She goes, just do it. I'm like, why? What? And she goes, you always look at my ear when you're trying to pay attention to me. So you think you're looking, so that I think you're looking in my eyes, but I know it's easier for you to think when you're not looking at me. So just do it. Oh. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah. So she knew a lot of little things. And you know,
I read that. I Googled it after we talked the first time, and I read that and I didn't understand. Well, I didn't get an example of, but now you're giving me the example of what's actually taking place as a person that's dealing with
that. I can't focus and stare in somebody's eyeballs. There's like, no, like, why am I looking in your eyeballs when I'm trying to think? So yeah.
Like, it's is that right? Is that like that for everyone?
I don't know. It's like that for me.
Okay.
I guess if you're neurotypical, meaning that you're not autistic, you get information from the eyes don't move. So I'm not really sure what you're getting. I don't get it. So if I'm trying to think or if I'm whatever, I kind of have to, it's a sensory thing. I just kind of block everything out and I stare into nothing, like into a neutral place. Mm-hmm. I guess she had noticed that. And there were other little things that she had done as well. So she just, so some of the younger ones did get it. And I think there's more awareness, thankfully, with the younger people that are coming up. Autism wasn't, they didn't start diagnosing children with autism until after like the 80s.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's been around, but like, as far as it being like a regular thing. Yeah. No.
Right?
Yeah.
Amazing. So you know what, then, you know, I think this whole situation is interesting because when you think about how judgmental Jehovah's Witnesses are, and if a person is dealing and suffering with something like this, or just not really suffering, I don't know if I should say that or not.
That's fine.
When a person has this type of a condition,
affliction, condition.
Or they're wired differently than someone else, I'll say, you get labeled.
Yeah.
And no one is trying to understand it. And right. Just like you said, if it wasn't written up in the article, if an article was not written up about it in the Awake magazine or the Watchtower magazine, then no one takes any outside information to really try to find out what's going on. So it makes me think about just other issues that people are dealing with. If you're dealing with an issue of autism, what other types of issues are people dealing with where they're being judged harshly because they're not, you know, following this prescription of the Watchtower?
Postpartum depression, for example.
Okay.
I don't think that the society really understands that or recognizes that. So someone is new with a baby and they're not behaving the way they think she should. They label her as an unloving mother. She's not a good mother. You know, those kind of things. Like, they always have a label if you're not fitting into a proper box. So if maybe you're struggling with PPD or something like that, and yeah, of course you're happy to be a mom, but there's like, you've got that surge of hormones that are just like getting depleted because you've just given birth, and it does affect you. It affects your body. And some women go through it a lot stronger than others. Yeah. You can be labeled a bad mother. And once you get stigmatized in the congregation, it's like digging out of a never ending hole or, anything else. If it's not something that's super recognized, like cerebral palsy or MS, like you don't have a wheelchair. So, you know, like you have to have a visible, and I remember having this conversation with my doctor when we were going through like Kingdom Hall survival classes.
Is funny. Kingdom Hall survival.
I did.
I'm going to tell you something. Even without having, something going on with you, I feel like everybody needs a Kingdom Hall survival class. Just going in as anybody. Because that is not a friendly place to be,
No. You
know? And, you know, when you think about this whole situation, think about this. Because Jehovah's Witnesses are not taught to get jobs that really have a career that may have good benefits, it makes me wonder how many people are suffering with different conditions that they don't have good insurance.
Right.
And so they don't get a chance to go to a therapist. They don't have a chance. They don't get a chance to go to a doctor that can diagnose them with something that they may be really and truly dealing with. And remember, before we stopped going to the Kingdom Hall, we had to be there three times a week, three different days a week, but five meetings.
Right.
And so can you imagine suffering from, you know, being around all these people, dealing with all these sensory issues and people trying to hug on you. And you got to go into this building every week, 3 days a week. That's got to be very hard.
There was a sister who, she was older, but she had some sort of chemical sensitivity. I don't know if it was because of her old job or something, like in her previous life, but she would get, she would basically get like a contact dermatitis all over her arms and they would get raw. If she had fabric softener in her clothing, or if she, like, somebody put a blanket under from the, like, if she borrowed someone's blanket at the assembly because it was cold, she would suffer, because at the end you would see like the welts on her arms and you would see like the, yeah. But there were people who just didn't understand that chemical sensitivity. That's just a new thing. There was a sister in my congregation in New York who, she'd get migraines and she would throw up from perfume. She had a perfume sensitivity, and I get that. And I remember another sister saying, oh yeah, she's got a perfume sensitivity. So she says, and we're supposed to be like a perfume hall, free hall, or, blah, 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 blah. Well, she can just sit in the back room. And I was like, really?
So insensitive. They're insensitive to people. I feel like all they know is you're supposed to be at the Kingdom Hall because this is where Jehovah's Spirit is. And anybody who has any issue that they can't be around people, they're dogged, they're judged, they're looked at. They're not, nobody thinks about them until it happens to them, right?
Yeah, they're there because they don't want to die. Mm-hmm. They're there to save their butts. They're not there because they give a damn about anybody. I mean, basically, to be a witness, you learn superficial love. You learn conditional love. You learn, don't get too close to your kids because you might have to shun them. Don't get too close to your dog because you might get an assignment somewhere else. I mean, you remember that where they told the people that, or the magazine where they talked about like getting rid of their dog? Really? Like, don't get close to anything. And also, if you see someone hungry on the streets, give him a magazine. That'll change his life forever. He's hungry.
Cause you're going to feed him forever. If he reads his magazine, he's going to get everlasting life. You're going to just give him a crust of bread. He's going to just live for the day. But this magazine will have him living for eternity.
Spiritual food has zero calories and the body needs 1500 to survive. Just like, just doing nothing. So,
right.
So that was actually one of the things that it's one of the things that I'm currently enjoying, is how important everything is, like living in the present moment, like today, like right now matters. So if I see somebody that needs something, it matters. If I hear something, I can actually fix it. I can feel like I've done something, because honestly, out of all the magazines that I replaced, most of them are old light. So they're not even helpful anymore anyway. Like, I just wasted my own damn time. it's true. Everything that you probably passed out is probably, you know,
you so get this fellowship for apostasy on some of that stuff, right?
Yeah. I think I mentioned, when COVID hit, I was part of our community emergency response team. It's, you get trained to respond to some of the natural disasters and assist some of the actual workers, like police, fire, medical. Mm-hmm. So I've been CERT for maybe 5 years. So when COVID hit, they activated my area and they rolled a lot of us into MRC, which is the Medical Reserve Corps, which means you help do medical disasters. And so we set up some COVID vaccination clinics, and mainly I was doing monitoring and like helping people with their paperwork, et cetera. But that is something that's immediate. And it was something to affect the entire community, not just Jehovah's Witnesses. Witnesses have this idea that the only thing that matters is other witnesses. Like, there's, it just, and only if they're in good standing. So even if there's a disaster and your kid is in that area, if they're not in good standing, you might not call and no one's going to get mad at you for it. So yeah, just like being a part of that was so, like, it felt good, you know, like, okay, I'm doing something.
Yeah. Instead of waiting for some future date to be effective and help people, and all you're doing is walking around a block, passing out Watch Charts and Wake magazines. And then as time goes on, those are no longer valid. And it's like you said, it's like you're kicking rocks, whatever.
Down the street. Or even like, so politically, I've learned so much. Being politically neutral actually kept us so ignorant as to how little things affected us. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're necessarily engaging in Satan's system when you say, I'd rather this person be in charge of things, or, you know, I'm willing to, when you basically vote and say, I'm willing to pay this additional tax because my roads need it. You know, like it still affects all of us. But the witnesses have this mentality of later, today doesn't matter. Let the guy starve. He'll be resurrected. You know,
But you know what that's really about? That's really about control. And Jehovah's Witnesses can't get you in. They can't let you get involved in those kind of things, because if you were to get involved in politics, if you were to get involved in getting a career and also the PTA at your children's school, and you would begin to do all of these things, there would literally be no time to do Watchtower stuff. And so a lot of that stuff is like they found a way to make it seem like it's biblical. Don't do this, because in the Bible, Jesus said a little thing. But remember when Martha was preparing the meals, and he said, one or two things is all you need. But they tried to find a way to, you know, weave all that thread that through our lives as well, when all that stuff didn't even mean that.
Right.
Because they wanted us to serve them and not to live our lives.
Yeah, they twisted everything. I think of like Jesus and the loaves and fishes when he was like, he could have been like, I could feed you, but in paradise, there's going to be everything. So I'm not going to feed you today. But he didn't. There was a need right then and there, and he took care of it.
Right.
And they weren't all disciples. He even knew some of them just, you know, they just. So. Yeah, I don't know. I'm so glad to be out. I'm like super happy.
You look like it too. And I know, because you can now control your environment. You can meet people and explain something that, hey, look, don't get too close. Hey, look, this is my condition. Oh, I'm going to Google it. I don't understand it. Oh, I got my iPhone out. I'm going to look into my Google on my iPhone, and I'm going to look at what you said. I trust you. I know you're a woman, but I trust what you're saying.
Right.
It's not like, I'm an elder in a congregation and I ain't never heard that because it ain't came to the magazine. So sister, you wrong. It ain't none of that. You're not dealing with that. So yeah, you're waking up real people now.
And choosing your own clothes and like without worrying about like, this might stumble somebody. Basically being your authentic self. I think there are a couple of parts to that. One, defending yourself. We learn not to defend ourselves. We learn to quote unquote turn the other cheek so that the elders or the bullies in the congregation can just run all over people. There's never any consequence for them because just wait on Jehovah to sort it out. So there are certain bullies, sometimes elders' wives, that just run rampant for years in a congregation and they never get put in their place because everybody's waiting on Jehovah when actually it's her husband and everybody else that really needs to like fix things, or somebody else just needs to stand up for themselves. So there's that. And then there's just the, when I get up and I get dressed or whatever, they're my choices. Like if I decide to wear, like this one, this is still kind of a little bit harsh for me because it's a little bit lower. And I don't know if you see, I kind of squirm a lot, but I'm fine. But as a sister, you learn to hide your body. You learn to hide the thing that was what makes women so appealing and so beautiful. You learn to hide everything about yourself and just kind of conform. I'm surprised they didn't give us uniforms.
True. That's a thought.
You know, like the Mennonites, where you can have two colors. So yeah, I'm happier than I've ever been.
So Em, can you tell our listening audience, you know, how long you've been woke and out of the religion and how you woke up?
Sure. I actually stopped going to meetings about 3.5 years ago. Just the hypocrisy, and I was overwhelmed and I just needed a break. But I promised myself I would go back during COVID. I think I mentioned that I was working, at one of the clinics and one of the vaccination clinics, and somebody came through the line and they had a blood card. And I said, oh, Jehovah's Witness. I'm like, yeah, are you familiar? I'm like, a little bit. And just kind of wave them through. But then it made me think about the blood issue and everything else. And we all know that they're controlling. So I went online to Google how the what the witnesses' stands were on the vaccinations. And instead, I came up with CSA. And I had never heard of any of this stuff. I didn't know. Like the entire time I was in, the Candace Conti situation, all those other things were going on. And I didn't know. So I'm like, how in the heck did I not know? I was homey, so I never looked into anything that was negative. And so from then on, I was like, okay, well, what else do I not know? And so I'm like, I went down a rabbit hole, and I came across so much stuff, not just the child sex abuse, but the United Nations, the letter to Hitler. I mean, it was a 3-day binge. And when after those 3 days, I was a hot mess. I was just, like I was horrified, abso-freaking-lutely horrified. Like, how did I not see that? You look at what's his name in the governing body, that like the really wacky guy?
Oh, Stephen Lett.
So like the first time I saw him, I thought, okay. But again, it was that common distance. Well, that was my like your first feeling. Like, you know, like there's something, this guy is not genuine. There's something wrong with him. It's not that he's a special needs person because he's acting like it, but he's not a good person. He's faking. This is not who he really is. But all of that stuff kind of got pushed down. And so as I'm reading it, all of those little ding-dings came back to me. And then I got onto a couple of the YouTubers. I went through this really angry phase for about a month or so. And I'm just kind of whatever. But now I'm at the point where I'm just like, I'm good. I'm actually very, very good. And I keep up with things on Twitter just to see little things, how other people are doing, little tips and tricks on how to survive. Like, has anyone tried yoga? I did for the first time yesterday. I'm moving on, and I'm learning finally to be authentic and to feel the feelings that I'm feeling in the present moment. And to, I guess I look at people differently as well. You know, back, so this right here was, it's a rose quartz from one of my vendors. And she just, it was just a gift. I don't know why. Sometimes they just send you stuff. And, you know, it's like a healing stone. This would have bugged me before. Like any, like the metaphysical stuff, it would have been like, and I probably would have stopped working with her. And now I'm like, it was a gift. It's a rock. I like it. Cool. It's rose quartz. It symbolizes self-love. And so, yeah, I'm going to wear it because
Isn't it amazing how the littlest things like that, we had to scrutinize it, and we couldn't wear it. We couldn't accept it as a gift. One of my old friends, still a witness, a lady gave her mother a cross on her job for a gift. And, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses don't wear crosses and stuff like that, of course. But she said, you know what? My mother never threw her gifts in the trash at work. She would just take it home and discard it when she got home, because she, heaven forbid that the person found it in the trash. So she took the cross home and discarded it. But you would think she could have just donated it if she didn't want it. But the lady has spent money on it, but she threw it in the trash instead of just donating it to somebody that might have wanted to wear it.
Yeah.
Didn't mind wearing it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I feel like all of those little boundaries kept us from really connecting with other people in our community. A neighbor the other day came knocking on my door because her husband had taken the other car and she needed a trip up the street. And I was like, yeah, you know, I could help right now. I'm not going to tell her, wait for Armageddon and see if you get resurrected. And then
see how that is, you know?
Yeah, like right now there was an immediate, so I could, or even some of the movies, you know, that I remember getting in trouble for watching Schindler's List because it was rated R.
I remember that kind of stuff. You couldn't watch it. Like this is like historical, but right. It's rated R. And you know how they rate stuff when it's rated R. It's maybe they only have one curse word, maybe they got two, and now it's got an R rating. Or something, you know.
It was sensitive. It was something that was considered sensitive, but it was also historical. And my thought was, well, Jesus was there, right? So why can't we? No, I was counseled because I'd watched it and told someone else that they, you know, it was a great. Yeah, no.
That's now you're not living that life anymore. But But M, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Critical Thought to tell your story. It has been so intriguing having you here. And I'm sure my audience has learned a lot. And I hope people will Google autism to learn more about it, because, hey, you just never know. That person that you work with or sitting next to is acting differently than you are because they're wired differently than you are. Right. They may be experiencing something similar to that. All right. Well, this has been Lady C. And I want to thank you so much, M, for being on the program.
Thank you.
Each year during the month of April, individuals and organizations across the globe celebrate Autism Awareness Month with events to educate local communities and raise public awareness about autism. It has been more than 50 years since the Autism Society held the first National Autism Awareness Month in April of 1970. Since then, autism has become the fastest growing developmental disability in the world.
This program was sponsored by Critical Thinkers.